just have a break and like on your own in a room.
Was a show called Binge in Manchester by my team. It was their final show, and they're friends, but they basically weren't always friends. And the show was Sam Ward directed, and he said there was a rehearsal where basically one of them was waving, and the other was like in the room, and he just had to move between them, like in the world.
Are we on recording already?
Yeah.
Okay, well, they just got a personal anecdote from someone else. Okay.
So are we beginning? Thank you, everyone, for coming on a Sunday morning when, quite frankly, I'd rather be in bed, so I can't imagine many of you want to be up either, to listen to us talk about feminism and theatre. We're really sorry to say that Ava couldn't join us, but would have been here, and it would have been lovely to have her. But we have Mary Higgins with us instead, which is so, so lovely of her to jump in. And really exciting for her to be able to talk to us as well. So we're going to be chatting about feminism and theatre and feminist theatre and whether there's a distinction between those two and a whole bunch of other stuff. And I like to think that panels are a bit boring and a bit hierarchical. So if any of you have anything you want to chime in, please just stick up a hand or even speak over us like I like to do at panels when I'm in the audience. Unfortunately, we're the only ones whose mics will catch those, so ultimately posterity will record just us. But we can recapitulate your questions if you want us to. Okay, well, if you project, you know, from the dark. So I'm Liv Auerhand. I'm a occasional dramaturg and director, and I write a little bit of prose on the side, and then I principally, my day job is with an LGBTQ youth work charity, and I'm associate producer of Alchemy, which briefly left my mind but has returned, and I'm going to let these panelists introduce themselves and then I'll kick off the discussion.
I'm Mary Higgins.
Do you want to tell us a bit about Hotter?
Hotter is a two-woman show that I made with my best friend and ex-girlfriend, all about hotness and bodies. And we interviewed women and trans people aged 11 to 97 with roughly the same questions, and made a show from it. So it sort of explores bodies through the lens of our queer relationship, although we're working on that, because that's not really in it right now. And yeah, I'm looking at honesty and chatting.
Thank you. I'm Hannah Greenstreet. I'm doing a PhD in contemporary feminist theatre, and I'm also critic in residence at Alchemy.
I'm Sasha Wilson. I wrote Call Me Fury and am a member of the ensemble, which we performed last night and will be doing again at 4:15.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about Call Me Fury?
Call Me Fury is essentially about the Salem witch trials, but told through the lens of the women whose voices weren't really heard in the Crucible. So it's taking the history and flipping it on its head and giving some of the marginalized people from history a chance to have a shout.
Okay.
And it's set to folk music, so why not?
Thank you. So I guess the first question I have is a big one, which is, what do you think the most important issues are from a feminist perspective when looking at theatre? And before we kick off, I thought I'd say that I think often in theatre panels, you have a discussion of the material aspect of theatre when people talk about producing theatre and making theatre. So there's a lot of talk of how to get funding, where does the funding come from, blah, blah, blah. And then you have a lot of talk of the artistic and discursive elements of theatre when people talk about politics of theatre. So people talk about, what is the feminist play? Does it have enough women in it? You know, all of what kind of stories are represented. But often the sort of material dimension of the politics in that kind of sense is neglected, I think, in those conversations, apart from when there is a critical point that initiates it, like the Me Too movement. And so I guess I'm curious whether there are things that occur to you as
important feminist issues within the theatre industry and practices of theatre.
I wonder whether you mean kind of theatre-making practices. Mm. Are there collaborative theatre-making practices that kind of circumvent traditionally gendered hierarchies in the theatre industry? So things like split riches, so two lesbian feminist performers or a slightly larger company and they work very collaboratively and practically and don't have that hierarchy, or feminist collectives like Monstrous Regiment. I would be interested to find out whether Call Me Fury was devised in that kind of collaborative way, or how you kind of brought that equality into the room.
Well, we don't have a director as such. I did all the research and then I put together a draft of the script with certain sections knowing they'd be movement or song or something and going, we'll figure this out in the room. But I would bring in sections of it, or so the first week of our rehearsals, we were here 2 weeks as part of our Alchemy Award. We had 2 weeks in residency. So the first week in residency, we took bits of the script and we would just devise around a scene or a prompt or something. So like, as we were improvising or as we were moving through the text, whole characters got changed around. So in one section, the scene was originally Elizabeth Paris, who is the wife of Reverend Samuel Paris, Tituba and Abigail. Tituba being the slave in the Paris household and Abigail being the niece. And later on in the play, we had had a section where Betty, who is the daughter of Reverend Samuel Paris and Abigail, and her cousin were having a shared moment of fear and anxiety. And then we just realized when we were doing the earlier scene that we should never really meet Elizabeth, because we don't learn anything from that relationship being the aunt and Abigail. It was stronger and more interesting for it to be Betty and Abigail. So whole characters got swapped around and we just introduced Betty in earlier. And so like stuff like that we found in the room and everyone was just putting forward their ideas. And I think that works really well because you have to be bold and sort of say everything that you think, and sometimes not every idea makes its way into whatever the final draft is. But I think then everyone feels like they have ownership over the work. So I'd like to work very collaboratively because also people are clever and actors are really clever. Actors are way cleverer than I think most of the time we give them credit for. So, and I say this as an actor. Like, I sometimes do feel frustrated when you're being treated like a living, breathing prop, when actually sometimes the writer is not a sacrosanct position.
That is what I was going to say. I think it might be about a rehearsal space, and you could have a rehearsal space with only women in it, and it could still not be feminist. It's very easy to feel like if you're acting that you are being forced to do something. I know, recently I had an experience where I was like being forced to do a scene that was really difficult to do and took a lot of like emotional input from me to do, because it was like troubling. And I would get like sort of like not great notes and then have to repeat it again and again. And that was like really, really difficult. And that was a woman, but I felt like this is where it feels like you have no power and you've just got to repeat what is actually really difficult for you to do. And that isn't, when there's sort of a lack of consent, and that's sort of like forgetting that an actor is a human being, and that everyone in the room is a human being, and you can't just like bash out difficult scenes as if they're not difficult to do. To do them well, you have to get slightly go there. So I think it's just a sensitivity about when you're making theatre, you're dealing with like real life people, and they will be drawing on real life things. necessarily about who's in the room, although that does make a difference. But yeah, I think something about that and consent and that sort of like on stage and off stage consent. Recently saw Dominic Peck's Drag Kings.
Mm-hmm.
They're amazing. And they always did their show Sex, Sex, Men, Then at the Yard, which had like the best built-in trigger warning and consent caveat that I've like ever seen pulled off, where they just said you can leave at any time and like we can leave at any time, and this everyone is in this together in terms of like it's a live thing, and if you're uncomfortable you can go, and if we're uncomfortable we can go, and acknowledging that like human beings are doing it and might need to leave, and building that into something so that the play doesn't fall apart if you can't. That's amazing for writers, I think, to be like, oh, this seems really difficult for someone to do. I wonder if there is a way that it could, or as a director, there are ways that this can go slightly differently, or can be slightly different if that actress does not feel like showing her bum to the whole audience today. I don't know. It could be a way of doing it.
Yeah. That's really interesting, like sort of building in ideas of consent for safety and consent into the art itself, but then also the production of that art, whether it's the rehearsal process or even before that. Finding of actors and finding other workers who are going into the making of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And audience. No readmissions is a shit policy, because it just means if you get freaked out, you're not coming back in. That's not very nice. Yeah.
Which reminds me of accessible performances as well, right? Like a couple of big West End theatres do periodic accessible performances for disabled people and families of disabled people with breakout rooms, and the whole structure of the play, whether it's the lighting states or the sound levels, and also sort of meta-theatrical frames like telling the audience that these aren't real people on stage, are shifted to accommodate an audience. And I think that comes into these questions, even though that's not necessarily along a line of gender, right? It's about building theatre.
So I guess it's also thinking about power. And who has power in the room, because there's a lot of feminist theory which goes in quite hard against the audience having more power than the performers, especially with things like stage nudity, and like is the audience somehow being a voyeur on this performer, and even if they do consent to the performance, what's the power structure at work there? So I think maybe that's the thing that almost feminist theory can probably be about anything. But you need to be really actively thinking about power and who has power in the room and where it's going, and trying to make that more equitable.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the people in power are often, it seems like, driven solely by, you know, the commercial output of what they're going to get, right? So like, you know, I was really pleased, I was so excited when Amelia did the show that was there for mothers to bring their babes in arms, or whatever the however they described it. So like all the children would be able to come, and it was going to be this lovely and accommodating space. And you know, you often feel like people are slightly unwilling to make concessions to the non-standard audience, but actually there are so many people out there that can't come because of access requirements, or because of childcare requirements, or just like anxiety, or whatever. And by making theater more accessible to those people, we're actually opening up that work to more of the population who probably do really want to come, you know. And I think that it's really lovely to be seeing more and more of that of late, but I think that's a lot down to, you know, the content and like the politicization of the cast of Amelia, and how they've been quite vocal about, you know, saying actually we should have this, and because they are a popular show and everyone's keen to buy tickets, those ideas have been accepted and have been, you know, taken forward, which is really exciting. But it shouldn't just have to be one West End show is driving it, you know, because I think, yeah.
It is, right. by a problem about commercialism there, because
oh, absolutely,
yes, the media is doing this great thing, and I really do think a lot of the, it looks like they've got an entirely female cast, quite a lot of female technical people, that all the producers are female, and they are doing a lot of good things, but the Babes in Arms performance has sold out, so like they're not they are making money, and the kind of feminism, I can say this because I've already written a review, that the kind of feminism messages they are supporting are quite mainstream and easy to get behind, and kind of pop feminism, mm-hmm. and quite commercially acceptable. Does that dilute the feminism of its message? Is it somehow co-opted because it is commercial?
I don't think so. I think no. I think that
sort of thing. Sorry.
Shall we just this?
Yeah. What? Like, I'm just interested in like what pop feminism means.
Yeah. I guess a movie annoyed me in some ways because it seems like quite an individualistic story, and I know they've split the main character into three parts, but it's all about her becoming a writer, and it's quite. So a critic like Jill Dolan would say that's a liberal feminist story, which is about basically a woman succeeding against the odds and kind of having success by herself rather than reforming the kind of material conditions. And I know there are bits in the media where she goes to meet the sex workers and like fisherwomen and the kind of consciousness raising with them and teaching them to read, but it's still quite an individualistic story. So that's what I mean. And I just wonder whether there are some limitations in the kind of things that are celebrated as feminist. Yeah. But I know that might be a bit controversial, so please say what you were saying.
No, I just, I do hear you. I suppose that also sort of taps into a lot of this chat that's been all over Twitter about Fleabag as well, that, you know, it's a white, affluent, middle-class woman. And my answer to that is that I just am not seeing enough other work of that I feel is, like, bold in its feminist message, that I'm glad that's there, because then, yes, it doesn't answer every question, and it doesn't tick every single box, and it doesn't solve the problem in and of itself, but I don't think it has to. And I think by just virtue of its existence, there are thousands of young girls who are going to go, I can do that too, or I ought to speak up, or I need to join in with this also. So yes, it is an individualistic story, but I think it is so charismatic, and it is so rallying. Like the end of that play, Amelia, Claire Perkins's monologue at the very end is one of the most stirring bits of theater I think I have ever seen in my entire life. So, like, I think it appeals to something that is much more universal, even though it is one woman's story.
I agree with you, and I disagree in that I think, yes, that last speech from Amelia is an amazing piece of rhetoric. It is really well performed. And I think Fleabag is an amazing piece of work, and I think we in general, especially feminist critics, I think I'm a feminist critic, I try to be, put harsher standards on work by women because there is less of it, and we want it to conform to this kind of political ideal when no work can really do that. But I disagree that of course there isn't enough feminist work out there, but I think there's a lot of feminist work that is coming in the last few years, and some of that calls itself feminist and isn't necessarily feminist. But I don't want to say what is and what isn't feminist, but I just get a bit frustrated sometimes because I get invited to a lot of shows that are calling themselves feminist, and maybe they're just female-led stories, and often they're like female-led stories about sexual violence, and it's just so depressing to go and watch that work if you think it hasn't been... I don't know, Mary, what do you think?
I don't know if I think like that when I go to the theatre, but I'm not a feminist critic. I'm just a stroppy actor, and so sometimes I'll be like, oh, that's not very good. But I don't know if I would like... I don't know if I would... and how tightly I would align it with... feminism, although it like could piss me off, but I, as you were saying that, I was thinking, is it just not very good theatre though sometimes, because it's very easy to slightly just, you just haven't quite got the right message, and so I think that's why I find it really difficult to like separate those two things, because often you can have such beautiful intention behind something, and sometimes you meet the actors after something and you're like, you're great people and you really seem to know, you know what you're doing, that's just not quite what I saw, and so there's just this, but there's so much to get in the way between intention and effect on someone, and then obviously it also just like entirely depends on how you're feeling that day. I don't know if I've, I do know what you mean about pop feminism, I think, although I would never say individualistic, although I really get that point, I just don't, that word wouldn't be in my head. I just like, I've heard that so many times before. I don't know if it needs to be said again quite like that. But again, that's a theatrical thing of being like, that needs to be said, but please say it in an exciting way. Please show me rather than tell me, or make me feel it rather than lecture at me. So all the things that I'm like classing it on are, I think, more like theatrical ones, because it's true of anything, like the biggest cliche, any love story, you can like be absolutely bored by it because you're like, I've seen this before, or just because it gets done really well, it's really exciting and beautiful. It's the same with feminism, I imagine, that sometimes it's telling a story about a woman and you think, I've seen this before, and sometimes it's just something about the actor or the writing, which is how I feel about Fleabag, that it's like the performances and the writing and the surprises and the other characters that aren't Fleabag and the way they interact that makes you just think, this is new, I haven't seen this before. There's an old lesbian talking about the menopause and then she's not going to kiss her, she's just going to go away. Stuff like that, it doesn't resolve that scene. Yeah. When it just happens that it doesn't, you're not expecting it. That's what makes me excited that like women are making things. I'm like, I actually haven't seen that one. Because I actually haven't seen that one.
It's absolutely fucking brand new. Brand new. And it's brand new, and then I think it is going to generate more work that is also going, I am bored of, you know, seeing reruns of Sleepless in Seattle. Like, my whole life is, you know, it's the, sometimes you go and you're like, why are we doing another revival of, like, All My Sons, for God's sake? Arthur Miller is a great playwright, but the number of people who came and saw Call Me Fury and were like, but actually The Crucible is really good. And I'm like, I didn't say The Crucible wasn't good. I'm just saying it's time for other things, exactly, new things that get you like... God, I just...
No, and I think fair enough to get impassioned about it. I guess one of the questions that strikes me during this discussion, and I think it's probably apposite at this moment to name the fact that we're all white women, is what kind of narratives or productions or companies or makers are being seen as celebrated, investable, watchable, and brand new, right? And how many of these narratives are actually being made by a very narrow category of who we call women. And I guess I'm curious about where we go if we want a grander feminism, a bigger feminism, a feminism that is more inclusive, that is more radical. Where we go from Fleabag, other than just to say we hope that inspires and we found that very powerful, because there's no need to see things as not working to say we want more, and that we want other intersections of identity to be represented in making.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that comes down to though the programming and the venues and you know the BBC or whatever. And as a creator, I have very little knowledge of what. Of all the machinations that go on to get something to that place. But I would imagine, you know, I imagine probably the people at the BBC were like, we're going to take a risk on this Phoebe Waller Bridge, you know. But they take a risk because she is, you know, close enough to them.
Right.
You know, and so, like, I kind of don't know what the answer is, except that when and, when you see work that's being made by people who are unique and exciting and interesting, mm-hmm. like, vote with your dollar, like, go to that weird show that's being made unlike the other shows and make sure that you're buying tickets so that they can, because there's no money in the theater, you know, like we're all doing it on a shoestring. So if you go and support the artists that are making the work that you think is exciting, they will have more of a capacity to continue to make it, and hopefully then somebody, you know, with clout will come along at some stage. And
I guess I think a lot about theatrical form for my PhD, and I feel like there are some theatrical forms that are easier to accept because they fit into our standard narratives of what makes good drama. So I think we need to expand the kinds of forms we are willing to accept as theatrically exciting in order to expand the voices that are, if we're being really serious about it, we need to change that too, and that's also a critical responsibility, I think. So things like, I've completely forgotten the name of it, but Nouveau Riche's show at the Fringe last year, yes, Queens of Sheba.
Oh,
that
was great.
Yeah. and it was kind of basically performance poetry, like intergalactic performance poetry, drawing on autobiographical themes. It was also, I found it really difficult to write about because it didn't fit into my standards of what is a play. Mm. And that really challenged me, but so many people saw it, so many people loved it, it really spoke to them. So I think we need to make space, and also another, the thing that was on at the Bush Theatre and the Rest of Me Floats, queer theatre, was just so fabulous and honest and amazing. And again, that's been picked up by the Bush Theatre after a fringe run. So I think we need to, it's like a collective responsibility to kind of think about the,
I really like both those examples because they both have huge heart, and I felt similarly, like, I want to love this so much, and then I've got niggling hangouts about like what I want theatre to do that they don't quite do, and I sort of don't care because I love the whole heart behind this. But maybe that's a really nice like idea of critical reception, as in to recognise as an audience member when it's not quite for you, and that's fine. You can still have like a great time in theatre, but like. I imagine so much of mainstream theatre, there are like large parts of the population that feel like it's not for them. But if you are a white middle class woman like me, you might think that might be a less common occurrence, and then it can feel quite odd. You're like, I don't like feeling semi excluded, and it can make you feel quite defensive. And I guess the thing is to sort of relax and be like, but it is and it isn't. As in, like, I should be here listening, and I'm going to learn anyway. And also. In relishing the fact that for once this isn't really for me, that's like quite
and that's cool,
refreshing.
Because it is for somebody, you know, that I love that.
Yeah, and I was really struck, I think this is so valuable in thinking about the forms that we're interested in seeing on stage and that we're willing to
mm-hmm.
watch. And Sasha, you mentioned programming and how if we're thinking about different forms that we're willing to put on stage and different forms of making the theatre, like we were talking about collective making a theatre, are there different forms of programming that we can imagine other than just the top-down, top-of-the-biz programmers who get to make the calls?
Well, I mean, is this the role of a collective? Things like, you know, party somewhere else, that's it. I guess, yeah, money makes things difficult because it, like Sophie was saying yesterday, it brings in a politics. But also people need to eat, so it's kind of it's tricky. It's really tricky. And in an ideal world, maybe all theatre would be made as a collective, and we pay everyone the same, and tickets would be free. But it kind of like, where would we get the money to do that?
I did my study abroad in Russia, and I just like I did find it so interesting because I lived in a building that was one of the last buildings that was still doing the communal living style. Pretty much everything else had been converted back to, you know, had been converted to a capitalist. And in my building was one of like the most, I didn't know it at the time, but one of the most famous Russian actresses who was in a shared flat with, you know, but, and there was something about, there is something that I did really, really love, that there is no feeling that art is a luxury from what my experience there. That, you know, all of my cab drivers had read Eugene Onegin or had gone to the Bolshoi because of the way it was being subsidized by the government. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it isn't elite to go to the opera. It is absolutely something that is, you know, open for everybody and encouraged and just sort of celebrated. So people recite poetry. Like, you go to a dinner party and they would go around and everyone would have a little shot and then each person would stand up and do a toast and they would sing songs and they would recite poetry. And there was just this feeling that, like, art is actually valuable to our lives and our well-being, which I don't think we have. We certainly don't really have in America at all. And I don't think we have that either in England. It feels like something that is extra, that is added on. And I think if we somehow, and I don't know what the answer to this is, but if we somehow make it seem like theater, music, dance is just as valuable in a way as science or math, then I think we will have, more support and a framework to open up who is allowed to do what, because it isn't so limited by money. Possibly.
Yeah, I'm gonna, like, this is a bit utopian now, but I sometimes imagine, yeah, well, I just think it'd be great if the sort of like looking after your earth mentality of like if you're going to chop a tree down, then you have to plant one. It'd be great if the same thing went for theatre. So if you have a massive show somewhere, then do one for free somewhere else. Because we were planning a sort of like crawling tour for Hot Airs, and like we were slowly going to some places. And my dream is that it goes to like home in Manchester, and then it also goes to a community centre or a school, where they don't have to pay us as much because we just got the money from there. That's sort of, so it's like a balance so that you can manage to reach people that wouldn't normally see it in a capitalist world. So you can still get the money and then... also such a joy performing to people that like wouldn't normally get to see your show. Their reactions is like fucking amazing and it's actually just much more exciting sometimes. But that's, yeah, that's about the audience, I guess. And that's sort of like intersectionality with audiences. Mm. You just want to show your theatres to people that wouldn't normally see it. And I know it's not how the commercial world works, but it's also different with a show like Hotter, because Hotter is made up of different people's voices, so, and it works like a rolling stone, so it gathers more voices as more people see it, because we need more people, and then they often end up being in it. So it has this sort of like snowball thing. Which means we are like thirsty to show it to people that haven't seen it before, because, or aren't like us, because if we chat to them at the end, which often happens, then we will learn something and it can be in it. But that doesn't work for all theatrical forms, but it has made me really think about who you perform to and why the limits of performing to the same people over and over again, which can be lovely, but can also feel a bit tired. And the most exciting shows we've had, well, it was one at Brainchild where people were at a festival and they didn't know they were going to go and see a show. That sort of thing. It's just, they just ended up in a tent. That is like really, really electric. But that's not how most theatre occurs. But I guess thinking about like the idea of a totally like a constantly changing audience, a bracket of people, and ways that you can get that to happen. quite an exciting way of thinking about it.
So I have a rounding up question, because I'm conscious that we're coming to the 45-minute-ish mark.
Wow.
Which is there something in theatre that you've participated in, seen or heard about that gives you hope in terms of a feminist theatre? Take your time. And if the audience have any questions, we'll be turning to you in a sec.
Well, this is upsetting.
I can't think of one on the spot.
I mean, I don't wish to bang the Amelia drum too hard,
but like,
given how contentious it's
but
been,
also,
yeah. Just every time you get to go to the theatre and you see something that you're surprised by, that gives me a lot of hope. It gives me hope because, like, it's just really nice to feel shocked and awed. To feel that something is playful or exciting, and though it is rare, it's not quite as rare as we think it is. And I love whenever that happens, which is a sort of really vague answer to your question.
I literally can't think of anything, and that's I'm like a really optimistic person. I feel hope about theatre all the time, but I just don't know if it's in one single production.
Yes.
I think it's more that like something happens or someone comes on stage or someone says a line and you're like, but I can't remember what they are. They're like little pinpricks, but it means that I don't tend to come out of the theatre ever feeling like totally depressed, because there's always something that you can be like, but that was great, that line was great, that person was great. But again, I'm not talking about feminism. I'm just talking about theatre. One woman shows give me life and strength. I like they're often the best things at the Fringe. I don't know why. They just often are. They give me boundless hope, because it's literally just a person telling a story, which gives me hope in theatre, because I'm like, you're just telling a story. You're on your own. You're telling a story. You've just got lights. Nothing else is happening, but I'm with you. That's exciting and hopeful. Plus, it's a woman telling her story, and that's amazing. And things like, actually, even though it didn't make me feel excited in an actory way, but The Rest of Me Floats did make me feel hopeful. Because I was like, this is a huge theatre, those people seeing this, the audience is full of queer people on stage and telling their own stories. And I don't have to like it that much for it to be hopeful. I think there's a big difference. Doesn't have to like inspire me as a theatre maker. It just makes you think, I'm really glad this is on. I'm really glad someone's doing this. I'm really glad it's happening.
I think that's a really important point, that because there has been a scarcity of female-led work, there's been more pressure on it to always succeed all the time and do amazing things. But actually, if it's not to your taste or it doesn't quite work, that's quite liberating. I think we need more of that. And so the thing that inspired me is not a show so much, but I did a workshop with Split Britches at the Barbican, which was amazing. And just having them share their practice and getting us all, so I'm not a performer, but they made everyone perform and generate lots of scratch materials with just the stuff we had, and just having that really fast way of making work and seeing that then transform into some of their shows was great.
That's a nice, I did a cabaret and drag lab at Soho, where you got a room of 20 people and we all had to make like 4.5 minutes of the cabaret and drag thing. That's the most inspiring 10 Saturdays of my life, maybe. But that's about people making things in a room of people chatting about what they would bring and their own queerness. And like, that was like a totally beautiful 2 hours of people showing new stuff and trying stuff out in a really welcoming environment. Like that, again, is like, that inspires hope. We're like, we're doing a sharing of something. It's fetal and the audience is receptive and judgment levels are down, and we want you to have a good time, and we want this to work. That feels so exciting. That's when like, you're like, theatre will make people like grow, and people will do stuff after this. There we go.
Are there any questions from the floor? No? We'll forgive you.
Think like all good things are low level feminist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know like how you I sort of like again what I was saying about having an intention then it going wrong or not coming across like that. Surely Fleabag's feminist. I don't know what I mean by that, but like it has to be. It makes me feel like it is. I don't really know where that is coming from. I'm not really on Twitter very much, so I've got absolutely no idea what people are saying about Fleabag. All I know is that, like, I love it and it makes me excited and it's funny and women being funny and real and ugly and lusty and complicated is feminist in my opinion. I don't think of it as a word which you have to be like, whoa, no. I've got the burden of feminism on my back because it just means doing you, like just truthfully doing you, and being honest about stuff. That's how I feel about it anyway. And so I really don't like it when the word is thrown around like a brick because it's not. It should be a releasing thing because it involves everyone. Like we were talking about, if you have a conversation about it, it starts involving accessibility because the whole point is it's not just about. Women, it's not just, it really is just like a substitute word for like goodness. And I think, I don't know, I feel, but then I don't go on Twitter, so I've got no idea.
I couldn't agree more. I just think it's so funny because I think the second we actually have parody in terms of we see just as many female driven things on television or on stage as we do male, as we do queer, as we do, you know, anything, then I think the pressure will cease being there because we won't have to go, we're fighting for our space, we're fighting for our space, and then it can just be what it is and it can be good or not good.
Yeah.
You're completely right.
Well, embracing everything that, I mean, I think you would be like, well, if I want to make something feminist, then I have to think about everyone. It can't just be about me because that isn't feminist. But I think, I guess it's then it kind of from then the difference is when people have a different view of the word in your head. And I do agree that there is like responsibility with it. I just said quite a whimsical thing there, and I'm just now backtracking on it. There is responsibility with it, because you've got to make sure that that it would feel feminist for others, and that you're not excluding people with your feminist work, because then it's not feminist. So if you want to make it feminist, then it has to actually do that, and you have to be conscious about those things. But what I mean is, it's not a burden; it should be like a freeing thing, because it's ideally all the dreams of feminism should totally coincide with the dreams of theatre, because it should they should want to do the same things. It should be about reaching different people, and it should be about telling different stories. So ideally they would just be sort of the same thing.
Hannah, do you have any?
Yes.
There's a question over there, actually.
Yeah. Is the question over there? No.
I just wanted to say that something that kind of truthfully doing you, but also being accessible to everyone. What if there's a conflict between people?
I think maybe that's kind of why I agree with Charlotte's point that we're in danger of being quite white feminist and just thinking, oh, feminism is a one-woman show by a white woman talking about how difficult it is, I don't know, for her to be a white woman in her 20s. I've seen quite a few of those shows. Like, is that feminist? I don't know. Or is that, maybe not is that feminist, but is that enough? Is that reaching the kind of feminist goals of intersectionality, is that doing enough to politically change the world? Because I think if you're saying something's feminist, You need to do that. It's not enough.
But what is that artist's alternative? I couldn't possibly agree with you more. But like, I happen to be, you know,
from the end.
Oh no! But like,
summation marks.
But I feel like it would be completely. You just can only. Well, I don't know.
Actually the crux, isn't it? We've basically reached the crux with the minute ago.
Yeah, I think we've reached the crux, so maybe we take the discussion out of the room. And I think as a which is exciting.
What's the crux?
Okay,
there
I'm
going to
give
go.
You 30 seconds and then I'll give a 30-second summary. Let's go.
You're totally right that you can't just do those things and they can be inspiring. And you're totally right that if you are a white woman in your 20s, then what are you going to do about the fact that you're a white woman in your 20s and you want to include other people? And I think that, but there are, you can still try for intersectionality from your own perspective, and that would be like limited because you're stuck in your body, and you can decide whether people have heard what you've got to say before, and then maybe if your voice isn't needed right now, not to blast my toot my own trumpet, but or me and Elle's own trumpet, but that is exactly why Potter is made the way it is, because we wanted to make a show about our bodies, and then we were like, well, we've just got to between us, and that's not very, that wouldn't be very interesting, and so it became about listening to other people, and so there are other voices on stage while there are only two bodies. And so there definitely are, if you have the inclination, there are definitely ways around the fact that, like, I only want to make a show with Elle, And so we're never going to be in an intersectional cast, and like because we work together really well, and maybe in the future that will be the case. But there's a limit on creatively, there's a limit on what we want to do as a creative team right now as a duo. That means we can't be the like flagship of loads of women of all descriptions and sexualities and genders on stage. But there are ways of reaching those people, and there are ways of talking to those people, and there are ways of making sure you're listening to those people when you're making your work, and then you're like being humble and being like, we should maybe change that bit because that's excluded someone. I think there are still ways of doing it. And I also still think the One Woman Show can be an amazing thing, but I also agree it's not the end.
Thank you. I think that's a really lovely compromise. And I think also maybe one of the challenges for us when thinking about political theatre and politics and theatre is to recognise that there are sometimes irreconcilable tensions. And I was reminded during this discussion of another cis straight white man, Brecht, and just cause, because I mean, one of the things that Brecht was saying with political theatre is that perhaps when audiences fully emotionally and joyfully identify with what's going on stage and are swept away by narrative, character, and feeling, that a politics can be suspended, disposed of, forgotten, or deferred. I mean, that perhaps there's a tension here that we've had come up again and again between the shows that we personally really like and really enjoy and a politics in relation to shows, whether it's the making of them, whether it's the politics in the show, whether it's the politics of the structures that allow the shows to be on the stages that we go to. And maybe that tension is one that we don't get to resolve in one conversation, but I have to keep thinking about. Mm-hmm. Because we need to leave the room now. Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
They live. I can talk to you so much about Brecht, like, and how he's been using the feminist critique of realism, or why that might not be
not a good use.
Well, I don't know. Glib use.
Glib.
I'd love to hear.
That was actually really fun.
That was really interesting.
That was fascinating.
Thank you, everyone.
I mean, literally.
You found it stressful.
You found it something you
somewhere
like.
Between fun
no,
and stressful.
Liberal feminism coming from all sides.
No, but it's probably because I mean, you've intensely thought about a lot of these things, whereas I was sort of taking things off my car.
But
they don't
talks.
Feel like, yeah.
That was really interesting, everyone. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Really fascinating.
Yeah.
Also, contact theatre in Manchester. Most of the programming committee are young people, many of them people of colour and queers, and they program work often in that vein as a result.
Yes, the programming Hotter potentially, yeah.
Yeah, that would be so
we'd
great.
Love that to happen.
Yeah.
Love to go there.
Fab. Okay, we've got to.